Welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. Today we've got a very special guest. We often get salespeople on the podcast, we get marketing people. It's very rare that we get to pick the brains of a business owner and a director and a man who's built a multi-million pound business from the ground up. And today we've got the great honour of being joined by Jason Majaria. Jason, how are you, sir?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
No, thank you for being here. So we always start off with the same question. It's one of those awkward questions that often people think, oh, why have you asked me that? But hoping you can summarise this better than most. So for anyone who doesn't know you, who are you and what problem do you solve?
Yeah, so my name is Jason Majaria. I own and run a company called CommuSoft. I think CommuSoft's primary function is to improve the working lives of tradespeople. So anyone that goes to site to service, maintain or install something. And so we are a job management and sales platform. And so we have different value propositions for what you're, you know, what we're trying to sell.
Okay. And something that I've not spoken to you about before, but where does the origin idea come from? So how did you get the idea and decide now's the time to pull the trigger on this?
I mean, I didn't start a company. I had a project when I was about 17, 18. And I had got off the back of selling a company already, and I was doing A-levels. And I had a family friend that said to me, hey, you're probably a bit bored like now. Do you want, I've got a plumbing company, and we've got this old DOS system. And, you know, how do you feel about helping us modernize it? I said, no, that sounds boring. Plumbers who want to help them. Anyway, I sort of hung out with this family friend for a while, and he sort of twisted my arm after a bit and was like, okay, look, I'll give you a hand. So I brought my laptop, you know, over one day. We were having a chat, and I just literally got my laptop out, started writing some code. He was telling me how his business worked, and I was building like literally then and there, and that went on for like the best part of a year. At the end of that year, I had a sort of product. I mean, I didn't think of it like that. As I said, it was a project for me. It wasn't necessarily, hey, I'm going to start a company and it's going to employ lots of people. It was purely to help this guy out and to sort of exercise a engineering muscle, you know, keep writing code, keep doing things that I found interesting. And sort of after it was mostly finished, and I use that word very loosely because lots of it didn't work and lots of it was sort of very half-assed. But at the very beginning, it was, you know, better, definitely better than what this particular person had. So I said to him, hey, it's kind of ready. Are you interested? You know, should we start the idea of deploying this? And at the time, he had a big falling out with the other directors of the company. And so they all went off in their separate ways. So I had sat back and I was like, I spent a whole year writing this. Someone should use it. Like, it doesn't make sense that nobody uses it. And so I literally went into the Yellow Pages and I picked 100 names of plumbing and heating companies in London. And I wrote 100 letters to 100 companies. Wow. And posted them. And one person replied, a gentleman called Ian Puddock. And he said, look, your letter's okay. I've got some tips for you. He happened to have been in marketing previously. Why don't you come to the office and we'll have a look? So off I trot over to his office, and he's like, this is great. I'll buy it. And that is what, 16, 17 years ago? He still uses it today. So their company still uses it. Obviously, it's come a long way since then. But yeah, it was a project really right up until only, you know, a handful of years ago that it got more and more serious, and I sort of sat back and realized that I had employed like 50 people, and I had really hadn't really, you know, put a business hat on. It was still for me just, how do I build the best product and help, you know, clients in the best way? And yeah, and now obviously it's a different beast entirely.
Wow. I'm interested in this letter. I don't know if you remember what you put in. Was it different for each company, or
it was roughly personalized but not really? I mean, it wasn't exactly the world's most advanced marketing. I think it was probably quite an honest letter. I probably have it somewhere, It was quite an honest letter. I mean, that strategy actually was how I built the first 30 clients. And they turned from letters to like printed postcards and stuff. And they turned from 100 to something like 14,000 or something at one point I sent in one go, which definitely confused the post office, my local post office, when I turned up and asked for 14,000 stamps. And I literally sat there in an evening and put 14,000 stamps on postcards. So,
wow. Amazing. I never knew that was the way things had kicked off. And then Ian is still with you now. So the problem that you solved then is still the same problem you solve now, in spite of the complexity and how the company's evolved.
Yes, I think we solve the reality. The way I look at problems, and I have done for a very long, very long time, is it's a pyramid, right? And it's my job to understand the types of problems businesses face at the bottom of the pyramid and the types of problems they face at the top. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you are the sort of business that has quite underdeveloped systems, your biggest problem is, I've got a Rolodex of customer names, how do I digitize it? Right? It's such a simple problem. And when you've solved that problem, you take a step up on the pyramid and you're going to face a different set of challenges. The reality is you always face those challenges, but they were just not front and center of your mind, because the bottom of the pyramid were the things that were causing you the biggest headache. And naturally, as you solve more and more problems in the business, you get higher up and they become more complex to solve and more niche to solve, to a stage where they're so niche and they're so complex that, you know, that even products like CommuSoft may never ever solve that something that specific. Now, my job, and has been over the last 17 years, is to understand the problems of the base of that pyramid, but also develop technology and understanding for businesses that have sort of climbed that ladder, as it were, climbed that pyramid, and now have really quite complex requirements that they want to solve. So, yeah, I would say, you know, a very simple business that comes to us, we can definitely help them. But then at the same time, if you are coming to us with very specific problems, that's the difference. We've just made the system more customizable and more, in some respects, more complicated to solve those things. So, but ultimately, we still talk to, you know, we still only work with trades companies. We still work heavily with plumbing and heating companies. And so sort of still talk their language.
Interesting. And you mentioned there, Jason, that obviously you've got a team of over 50 now. We're in the beginner stages of our leadership. So obviously, as a leader, what would you say are some of the biggest do's and maybe some of the biggest don'ts when it comes to leading a team and growing a team?
So for me, there's a very big difference between managing like under 10 to then 25 to 50 to we're 85 now or 86
now. Wow.
I would say that the biggest lesson I learned was as soon as you start introducing management levels, and that's like you not just managing everybody, which you can do really up to 10 or 15 people. It becomes it harder, but you can kind of have a really strong personalized relationship with everyone. At some point that changes and people's attitude towards you change as well. You're not just, you know, the guy that I talk to every day and is like really friendly and really gets to know you. You become someone of an authority figure that maybe newer members of staff that don't necessarily work with you directly, they don't necessarily have that really strong personal relationship with you that you might have done with the first group of people that you first hired, see you very, very differently. So the mistake I made very early on was assuming a desire to manage people or instantly gave you a skill to manage people. And I see this so often with like my friends, especially where, you know, some of them now are obviously quite far into their careers and they've been given teams and, you know, in some cases, you know, significant numbers of people, and they have never, ever been trained on how to manage someone. They theoretically have no skills on management. The skills they've gained is because they were managed previously, so they just kind of copy. And I think that's really dangerous because you naturally, because that person they were copying hasn't had no skills either. It's a perpetual cycle. And I made that mistake very early on with a member of my team that I knew really well, and he had an interest in building a team and managing. And so I was like, yeah, cool, we'll just hire somebody, and then you've got a person, you know, a person that you can manage, and we'll sit down regularly just to see how it's going. And what happened was that he ended up leaving because, and I said, and I know this because I spoke to him, because he felt so overwhelmed by and under-skilled, basically. He didn't know what he was doing. And he really stressed him out, created a lot of anxiety. And so he was like, I'm done with this, I'm off. And that obviously then, you know, leads to other problems as well. So the biggest thing for me has been management training. Not just me teaching people, but actually bringing people in to provide a really structured set of tools and guidelines to develop a company. So now, as a business, if we're even thinking about having you manage somebody, even if it's not this year, maybe it's even next year, then you'll sit on management training this year, and you'll have a set of structures and tools. Like, what does a one-to-one actually look like? What should you be talking about? You know, what does a performance review actually look like? How do you set someone's KPIs? So all of that then gives people at least a basis to have a really sensible conversation with somebody else. Because at the end of the day, you know, if you join a company and it's shit show, basically.
You could say shit show.
Right? Then you're not going to have a good time as an employee. You know, it is going to be painful. You're not going to know where your career is going. You're not really going to know whether you're doing a good job or not. And that lack of direction, I think, is ultimately what sort of kills a company. So I think, yeah, management training and having a really strong structure is, for me, the biggest change that CommuSoft went through.
Okay. And so when you started off, obviously you were still quite young, so you had that desire to maybe manage a team, and you knew that you wanted to grow the company eventually, but maybe not necessarily the skills. What did you do for yourself to say, right, I'm going to... Did you bring someone in to train you straight away, or what else did you do to get better, and what could...
No, I went through the same problems that all my the early team members did, which was we didn't have the skill set or structure for it, right? I think naturally I trust people off the bat. That's been, and some people complain, some of my leadership team sort of complain that that's my default, is to just trust people. So I hired a lot of bad people, and I have hired a lot of good people over the years, and what's happened is the good people have stayed for a very long time, and thankfully the people that I didn't get on with, I won't call them bad because they're not necessarily particularly bad, but the ones that I didn't work well with left, which is pretty natural. What happened, though, was I had this kind of aha moment when it's like, look, we're big enough now, and I think we're ready to bring in somebody to manage other people. But prior to that, I don't know necessarily whether I was managing people very well, but I had a strong positive relationship with them that I think they kind of clung on to enough to say this is a good place to work, rather than my career is developing and everything else. So my perception of management has definitely changed. At the beginning, it was have a nice relationship with people, get on well with them, you know, be open and honest. You know, the open door policy is kind of rubbish. I mean, an open door policy is kind of useless if no one uses it, and most people don't use it. So structure, sitting down with someone weekly or two weekly, and just having a simple... I mean, I ask the question every single one-on-one that I have, which is, do you need anything from me in the next week? You know... Because next week when I say, how are you getting on? And you say, I needed help on this. You should have asked me last week. I opened the forum, was there. I would, hands on heart, and say I was pretty useless at managing at the beginning as well. I went through the same training that everyone else did and adopted the same structures that CommuSoft did. I just think I was lucky in that I hired early a group of really good people that saw past maybe some of those limitations of my skill set and enjoyed working in the environment.
Okay. And you said earlier, Jason, when you were talking about, obviously, as the company changes, you can't have that personal level with everyone you grow. And there'll be people that come into the company and they might have a different perception of you. You might be the most fun-loving guy in the room, and then there's new people who think, I've never seen that man smile before. You never know how it goes. So how do you, as a leader, what do you do to engage new people and not... maybe have that personal touch. But what do you do for the new people that come in to show those leadership skills?
I try to, and I'm not going to say I do this perfectly every time because I definitely don't, but I try to. So for example, there's someone joining tomorrow in the marketing team. So they will work for my direct report's direct report. So it's not like we're 20 levels deep or anything. Like, that's not how this is working. But it's enough that I if I wasn't invited into the interview, because maybe I was away or I wasn't around, often I do get invited, at least for the last one. But if I wasn't, like I wasn't for this lady, what I will do is when she joins tomorrow and settled in, you know, a day or so, I will drop her a message that just says, I've never been introduced to you formally. Are you okay if I drop 30 minutes into your calendar? If you're in the office, we can have a coffee. If you're not, it'll be a Google Meet. And I'll just tell you a bit about myself and tell you a bit about, and you can tell me a bit about yourself. And it's usually like 30 minutes. You know, I'm not there to try and interrogate them. That's not the purpose. Often I will try and spend the same amount of time talking about myself as they talk about themselves. So I will tell them some of my hobbies and some of the things that I like doing. Basically, an attempt at humanizing with somebody, so that at the end of the day, if they have a problem and they don't know where to go, they can message me on Slack and they don't feel intimidated to do so, because they're like, oh yeah, I met that guy, he was nice, he liked yoga. And it's like, okay, you know, I can message him on Slack and he's not going to bite my head off. And I know that it does work, because I've had employees in the past that have joined that have sort of said to me afterwards, in my previous company, I could never have, you know, I could never have messaged the owner of the company. It just wasn't, you know, it wasn't socially acceptable. It wasn't acceptable in that environment. And so, you know, who am I to impose a set of like expectations on somebody that they should feel like they should contact me? It's not like if they've had an experience in the past where that wasn't acceptable, they're going to bring that experience to this company. It's up to me to not only break that and say, look, you can just contact me, you can just message me, but also it's up to me to set the tone of how the company, I want the company to operate.
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, and that probably brings me on nicely to the next point. So obviously one of the there's many things, as we were discussing earlier, that get thrown around on LinkedIn, and culture is one of the big ones. So like having an hour to play ping pong or maybe doing a yoga class. But Jason, what have you found that actually works in terms of culture that delivers on the business goals but also retains good people?
The first thing is unfollow all of those people on LinkedIn, because they just get my blood up boiling. It's so annoying. I think, like, look, there's a perfect scenario for everything. I just don't think, I mean, I've not been able to create that perfect scenario at CommuSoft. I think, I say this to every new starter, either in the interview or afterwards, my job is to make sure that on a Sunday evening, when you're thinking, I've got work tomorrow, sort your bits out, whatever you're doing, you're thinking, I've got work tomorrow. Not, oh, I've got work tomorrow. God, I hate it. But I'm also not expecting, yeah, I've got work tomorrow. Because, I mean, this is not an unrealistic world, right? I want a sort of positive, but not excessively positive, like understanding of that you've got work tomorrow. I want something that you're thinking, yeah, it's work tomorrow, but you're not excited about it necessarily, because I'm not expecting people to be, you know, jumping for joy. But at the same time, if you're sat there feeling down about the fact that you've got to come and work at CommuSoft tomorrow, then I've done something horribly wrong. And to me, that's like the basis of how the culture then starts. And you kind of get into like remote working and flexible working and all this sort of stuff. And I think principally these ideas are lovely. I think practically they're really hard. Flexible working is a perfect example, right? And I think that's been talked on LinkedIn, especially more recently, where everyone is like, yeah, everyone should be flexible. You should be able to work whatever hours you want. Knock yourself out. If you're a 1 a.m. person, you should work at 1 a.m. Great. Do I tell my clients to also wake up at 1 a.m.? If they've got a problem or a query with the software, they've also got to wake up at 1 a.m. because that's when they like to work. Our support team like to work. No, of course not. That doesn't make any sense. Sales. How the hell do you do a sale at 1 a.m. unless you're selling to, like, you know, Asia or something? It just, doesn't make any sense. And then you get into this, like issue with culture, where you can say, look, marketing team, you're writing blogs and doing other stuff. Knock yourself out, work at 1 a.m. But anybody customer facing can't. Now what? now there's like a privilege, there's a weird privilege disbalance in the company where software engineers who can write code at 1 a.m. and marketeers that can write a blog at 1 a.m. but your you know, salespeople and your customer service people, they can't, they have to stick to office hours because actually that's what the business needs. And I just don't personally feel that's a positive culture. Yeah, you've given half the company flexibility, but you've also told the other half that they're not, that you can't give them flexibility. Now, logically it makes sense, but people are not logical. They'll just sit there going, well, so-and-so can do it, why can't I do it? So, yeah, I think, you know, if you're a marketing agency or you're a, I don't know, a development house or you're something where everybody's not customer-facing, then you probably could get away with it. But if you're selling anything on the phone or even over email, like if I got an email at 1 a.m. from a salesperson, I'd be sitting there going, what the hell are you doing sending me this email at 1 a.m.? And if you've woken me up especially, I'd be even more annoyed. So yeah, I think culture for me is like a very simple principle. And I kind of lay mine out. I've laid mine out. And decisions have to come from that that basic principle.
Okay, and that kind of indifference, I love the way that you put it. It's like, it's realistic rather than sitting there as a running a company and being like, no, I want everyone to be there, buzzing, they can't wait, they've got the uniform out. It's just being human and understanding how we all work. It's that indifference of, as long as you're not dreading it. Because I'm loving the story about when you started, was there anything from when you started that was like a non-negotiable, that as I grow this company in terms of culture, this is like a hard fact that we'll always do this. This is the way that I want to lead and I want to bring this culture into the team.
Decision-making and culture are two different things. I think in terms of like the decisions I made and the link to culture weren't necessarily connected in my head. I wasn't thinking culture, make decisions based on culture. It was more like do what I want for myself, for other people. So if we had a policy, like we introduced a maternity paternity set of policies a few years ago, and I sat back and thought, and I had a baby last year, so I was like, what would I want for myself and for my wife? And then everybody else should have the same, because if I shouldn't be any more privileged than anybody else. It shouldn't be like, well, I could do whatever the hell I like, I just take 3 months off if that's what, you know, because who's going to tell me off for doing so? So it's like, well, if I think a month paternity is an acceptable amount of time and I think that's reasonable, then that should be reasonable for everybody. And again, it wasn't about culture. It wasn't about building culture. It's just like trying to make sensible moral decisions that ultimately, yeah, you could argue lead to a sense of culture. But that's not necessarily the angle that I took when I made the decisions.
Wow. That's reminds me of me and Jack put in when we started off, I think we stole it off Stephen Bartlett, so it wasn't our idea, but we put this policy in where you can take time off unlimited. So, you know, if someone needs to take a day off to go to the doctor in the middle of the day, it's not a big like part of your holiday allowance or whatever. And we hired an ops director in, I feel like it was about 6 months ago now when Ben started, but he basically said, if you don't also do that, it doesn't actually look like you can do it to the rest of the people in the business. It looks like something that you're just saying, oh, we do this thing, but actually don't do it, which you hear a lot of horror stories about.
Yeah, shiny
recruitment companies and things like that, you know, saying, just shiny, oh, you can go home then. Yeah, exactly. So that's a great way of looking at it. I'd
say that those types of policies work really, really well at a certain size. And then as you get bigger, again, it gets down to this, like, how much is too much? Like, if someone started taking every Friday off or every Friday afternoon off, at what point do you step in and say, no, you shouldn't, you can't, that's ridiculous, don't do that? It's like, well, the policy says I can.
Yeah.
It's like, because there will always be someone that takes the piss. Like, and I'm not saying they're doing it on purpose. I'm saying that, you know, you grow a company and I'm not, and you know, we're 85. There's always someone that's not quite as passionate as you are about building a company. And you will always need people to do certain jobs that doesn't necessarily require them to have the craziest ambition to be like directors and managers and everything else. They just want to come and do a job and they want to be good at it and you know, get paid and all the rest of it. And so you will get scenarios where people come in and push the boundaries of what you think is sensible. The problem with a very open policy is that it's very open and therefore open to interpretation. So they think, oh, I'm doing what the company is allowing and is expecting and is fine. But actually there's like a there's an overlaid expectation that's not written down. You know, your expectation that's not written down that says, well, no, actually that isn't acceptable. It's like, okay, now what? So like boundaries, I think, are quite good things. Policies that have boundaries and that set out like what's in your head as an expectation and what you want as a company, and they should line up. Because if you have a one-on-one with somebody and they are you perceive them to be taking the piss of this policy, that's completely unfair to them. That is entirely your fault. That is not their fault. If they take every Friday afternoon off, you should not blame them. You should blame yourself for not writing a half-decent policy. And I think, you know, I've learned that over time as well. Like, it's good to have a set of reasonable, good, sensible rules that everyone can follow specifically and that doesn't have an undertone of, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. Like unlimited holiday policies, right? The tech companies around the world have been super well known for doing that. And as you said, horror stories of people taking like 3 days a year because no one quite knows, is the written policy what your manager is expecting or is it not?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny when you were talking then, I was thinking every time we have someone on and we end up talking about leadership, the point that's always alluded to towards the back end is really it's about being clear. Like clarity is the ultimate component to the whole thing. It's, does everyone know what their job is, what's expected of them? Do they know I'm going to have a tough conversation if this happens? I'm going to get praise and bonuses and things if this happens.
And I would go one step further and say, how does that affect the direction of the company? This is something we recently have been developing, which is I set a KPI for a SDR. Okay, so they're new member of staff. They're probably 20 to 28, something like that. Typical age range, you see it, that role. And they may have been working a year. They might not even been working a year out of university. They join us as an SDR. We do a ton of training with them. And then what impact do they have on the business? How do they know? Have we sat down and said, your target is this, okay? And this is why it's that target. That flows into this for this person to close that business, which flows into why the company even exists. So like, is that conversation actually happening? And I would say the higher up you are in the company, the easier it is to connect the things that you're doing to the overall company goals. The lower you are in a company, or the more junior you are, I should say, the harder it is for people to understand that. And different roles are even harder. Sales is in some respects quite easy because it's all very number based. You know, if we make this and there's this many of you, then we make this and therefore this is the growth expectation of the company. But like in customer service or customer operations for us, you know, why does it matter that you send personalized Loom videos to support a client? Who cares? But if we can explain that story and that direction, then it makes such a big difference to how people feel about the work they do.
I would imagine a lot of businesses, if they were honest, would probably say they do the first part, here's the target, but probably not the why we do something.
Yeah.
And without the why you do something, it's probably not going to be clear why I'm getting out of bed every morning to do it.
And I would guess if most managers sat down and tried to write that down, they wouldn't be able to come up with a story either. Because the targets are probably wrong, or they're probably kind of rubbish. They're just created for the sake of the fact you need a target.
Yeah,
I mean, sales is different. Sales is definitely different. But for other roles, it definitely changed that thinking. Definitely changed the targets we set out. We changed them because we were like, why are we doing this? And how does that impact the bigger picture? And if I can't figure that out, then I definitely can't spin. I can't tell that story.
Yeah. Let's change lanes then now to, I thought this would be an interesting area to discuss because we'll have on a sales guru, a marketing guru, but probably quite rarely someone who actually puts things in place in both worlds. And there's a conversation on LinkedIn, you see it all the time, sales versus marketing. Feels like a silly conversation to have. But from your standpoint, what is the role of sales and marketing and what actually works?
So I would say my understanding of that question has changed dramatically over the last probably 7 years. When I you know, roll back 7 or 8 years, 7 years, say, I hired, who is now the head of marketing, Maureen, as my first like marketing hire. At that time, I really hadn't hired sales. And I would say it was another 4 or 5 years before I really understood what I was hiring when it came to sales. Now, we developed, in our case, an inbound strategy for marketing. And at the time, because it was predominantly inbound, the sales team were very reliant on the marketing team. We didn't really ever do any outbound or any outreach in any shape or form. And we didn't really hire necessarily very experienced salespeople. We hired people and then sort of gave them a phone. And that, again, was a mistake that we made. What I would say that we did, though, is we tied the budgets of sales and marketing together. So it was one budget. You spent money and you made money. And like at the end of the month or at the end of the quarter, it was like that the pot was what was left between them. So there was very little arguing between them because actually, you know, the final figure, the final set of numbers that we created encompassed both. And often the arguments that I've seen, again, with friends and my wife is in marketing, works for a tech firm, is always, you've spent X, you've generated this many leads, but you haven't closed them, but you haven't given me quality leads. And that didn't really exist because at the end of the day, it was just kind of like one set of numbers. And the number was either good or bad, and they kind of shared it as a whole. That changed in more recent years when, A, we understood better about what we were selling and how we were selling it. And also when we started outbound. And one of the things that we split the budgets, but we also then said it is the responsibility of marketing to produce a percentage of the leads, and it's the responsibility of sales to produce a percentage of them. And they can then be measured based on both those percentages. For me, so far, anyway, that's worked really well. We also have a weekly smarketing call, and I didn't make up the name, but basically sales and marketing sit down and they have a conversation about what's working and what's not. Anyone in the sales team can join and anyone in the marketing team can join. Doesn't matter what level you are, like whether you're brand new or whether you've been here for 7 years. And it's quite good because you'll get a salesperson that rocks up and says, I had this interesting conversation with this prospect and this is maybe what they said. That then leads to marketing content. It might lead to a change in the website. It might lead to, you know, anything. So it allows them to really work a little bit more closer together. But yeah, I mean, there are times where I spoke to the sales, you know, Jack, the head of sales, and he said, oh, we've not done so great because there's no marketing. You know, there's fewer MQLs this month. And so the change to outbound and the change to saying, well, you're responsible for 30% of the MQLs now through outbound. So have you done that? No. Well, don't come to me with kind of excuses then. So I think, yeah, the perception of that friction between marketing and sales have definitely changed in the last 7 or 8 years based on who we've hired, how we've trained, our approach to the market, and also how we manage budgets.
I think that is probably a LinkedIn clip there for a talking point of ownership and accountability for both teams, because you're right, traditionally they're teams that don't get on very well and there's a lot of friction there. So I thought it was a great shout on the tied-in budget, but also the shared accountability of what your lead generation target is for both teams.
We've also moved to, so we used to have, and I mentioned earlier about when KPIs are wrong, right? And there's an amazing book, IBM book, basically. It's a guy that took over IBM as the CEO, joined, and IBM was on the decline. His job was to turn it around. And it's a really interesting book because this guy, one of the first things he does is digs into the sales process and the sales targets. And it was all based on numbers, right? So you've got to hit £10,000 in sales or whatever. And what he realized was it wasn't based on profit. It was purely based on revenue. And so there was instances where salespeople would take the IBM private jet, fly it across the country, sell one server for $3,000 and fly back because that made them hit their target. But they spent 80,000 on the bloody private jet there and back to sell £3,000 worth of software or hardware. And so that was quite an interesting point for me to really, really keep thinking all the time. Is this target make sense? Does this target make sense? And we had that problem with marketing where it's like, can you produce 200 MQLs for us this month? Can you produce 300 MQLs this month? And then the tricky thing with that was, do I want 300 interested prospects, all of 5 users each? Or do I want 10 prospects of like 1,000 users each? Financially, it might be exactly the same. But like, one is lots of volume, one is size of volume. And so all of a sudden, you're like, well, wait a minute, actually, what do I want? What is the goal? And so we changed it to pipeline created, which basically means if you go ahead and give us a lead, it's got to be qualified by the sales team. So there's a bit of a check and balance here, right? If the sales team says this is a crap lead, throws it back, it doesn't count. So the marketing team are responsible, the sales team are responsible because they're kind of connected. Marketing comes in and says, here's 20 leads, and I believe they're of good quality, and I believe they're of good size. The sales team go, yes, no, yes, yes, yes. And the pipeline that's created is what we measure the marketing team on, and nothing else.
Another great idea. What you're making me think of then is there a difference in the messaging of what marketing use to create MQLs compared to what salespeople use to create MQLs? Does the language change?
Yeah, because obviously with marketing, the channel, there's so many varied channels. Whereas with sales, at least the way we do it at the moment, is it's cold outreach, right? It's engaging with prospect. And so the patience of someone, as you'll know, when you're making a cold call is very different than someone perusing the website, your website at like 2 o'clock in the morning, which a surprising number of people seem to do, right? So you've got such a short period of time and you know less about them that you want to sort of get to the crux of something very quickly. Whereas if you have somebody that's, say, coming in through a blog post on a long-term, you know, long-tail keyword for a very, very niche specific problem that you've written a blog post on, and they're slowly converting down a funnel, then the messaging is completely different. You know, the whole process is completely different. It might take someone a month to get down the funnel to the point where a salesperson talks to them, whereas a cold call is very much, here's 3 key value props that we solve for businesses like you. Do they make any sense? And if the answer is no, it's like, cool, okay. If we can't help you with those 3 things, that's no problem. Definitely very different. And country makes a big difference as well.
As in?
The way we approach the US market to the UK market makes a big difference. The things that the US market search for and the type of messaging that we use on the website is quite different between the two. And we have a UK website and a US website with completely different content on them.
Could you give maybe a small example of what something that might be different?
Yeah, so traditionally, and obviously I'm broadly speaking, US companies are slightly further ahead in terms of the adoption of digital tools. And so going into a US prospect and saying, we're going to help you digitize your customers so you can easily access them. We're going to help your business understand where your technicians are and when that job is complete, is a complete waste of time for a US business, because 90% of them have already solved that key problem on my pyramid, and they're talking about much more difficult, sophisticated, nuanced issues that they have. Whereas the UK market, an awful lot of businesses that we talk to are greenfield, which means they don't have any systems. You know, if you ask them what software they use, they'll tell you Outlook and Excel. And so the whole sort of value and proposition is completely different. The US market also seems to either want to spend no money, or they'll just write you a blank check. They don't seem to care. There's no middle ground to them, right? They're either willing to spend a lot of money because their problem is so specific and so nuanced that they just need it solved, and they're willing to spend money to solve it, or they're saying, is it 99 cents? Because if it's not, I'm not interested, sort of thing, you know? And so you really, really have to have a really strong, refined understanding of your target audience in the States, much more so, I believe, that in my opinion, than the UK.
Interesting. And Jason, you're in a very competitive space. So what is the healthiest relationship that you should be having with your competitors?
It's an interesting question. I had one of my competitors reach out, and I've never spoken to him before, last year, to say, do you want to have coffee? Which I thought was kind of interesting. And I was like, yeah, cool, I'll come down to have coffee with you. I think competitors are a tricky conversation, right? Because we all have different levels of respect for different competitors. We all have heard stories, good and bad, by competitors. I'm sure competitors have heard good and bad stories about us. My feeling in the UK is we have a couple of them. On one hand, I would say one on one hand of what I would classify as competitors. I'm sure others may say that they compete with us when I don't believe they do. In the US, it's more like 20. There's so many more. So again, it's very, very different. And again, in the UK, I would say there are a handful. There are a couple that are really good, good products, good services, different angles. Like we naturally, you know, position ourselves very slightly differently. And there are some that I just don't think are very good companies and don't think are, you know, particularly, you know, fantastic businesses necessarily or technologies. And I think I look at it very differently because I'm a tech. I'm not an engineer now, but I was a software engineer. And so often the way I look at it is like, okay, the technology first rather than the sales and the marketing. You know, what is the product? But I mean, honestly, one of the competitors called me up and said, do you want a coffee? I'd have a coffee with them. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Would I be very mindful of what I said and didn't say? Yeah, I think you'd have to be a little bit, right? I don't think you want to sit there spouting lots of secrets. But at the same time, I don't see that it's like it should be hostile. I think you know, we go for the same business. If we win, great. If they win, there's a reason for it. We need to learn and move on.
And we find that when we speak to a lot of leaders, sometimes comparison can obviously be the thief of all joy, as we know in life. Do you ever find yourself in situations, Jason, where you're looking at competitors and thinking, hole, I'd like a piece of that, or why aren't we doing that, or we should be there, and how do
I
you combat that?
I went through a period in my career like that, and it's a rabbit hole, right? It's a complete rabbit hole of depression and sadness. So what I kind of, again, had this sort of semi-aha moment that was like, what am I doing? Why am I sat here stressing about these other companies doing their own thing? I need to be just focused on what we're doing, and I have to believe that what we're doing is right. And if I don't believe what we're doing is right, and that's why I'm comparing it to somebody like some other company, then I've got a fundamental problem with what I'm telling the company, the direction of the company should go in. So now, and I get it now, like someone will message me, especially the sales team will be like, have you seen so-and-so? They're releasing this. And I'm like, I don't care. Doesn't matter. We have a vision. We know what we're doing, especially in product, you know, especially product. It's a long vision. Nothing is short term when you write software. It's like 2 months, 6 months, year, 2 years. I mean, we've just launched this sales product, sales CRM for trades. And it is 54 man years worth of work to produce. It took us 54 man years. So it's not short term, right? It's long term. So if every time you question because someone's doing something, you'd never finish anything and you wouldn't see that vision through. And so, yeah, as I've got a bit older and maybe slightly more experienced, I now don't focus on any of that. It's just, what do I want? What do I want for the company? And that's all that matters.
It's very stoic, and which is great. You know, you've set an intention. Doesn't matter what the world's doing around you. Like, that's where we're going.
You just got to focus on it, because it's dangerous, right? Like, it's so dangerous, because you might get a big prospect that comes along and says, I'm worth 70 grand. If you just do this for me, I'll sign. Get it all the time. And now I'm like, no, just tell them to get lost. Either they like what we have to offer and they like the vision of what we're producing here, or they don't. If they don't, cool, that's fine. If it's just something like 10 minutes, it's like a cost, it's a configuration rather than a completely changed product, then yeah, I'll talk about it, right? It's part of the negotiation. But often it's not. Often it's like, I need a new feature like that does this. And it's like, yeah, but I'd have to pull people off projects that I genuinely believe are the future of the industry and of CommuSoft. The cost of that, with that genuine belief that bringing that thing out will change people's lives and change people's businesses, if I delay that by a month, what's the cost to the business as a whole? And what's the cost to the industry as a whole, you know, by doing that? And I think it's just too easy to get pulled off plan. And if you put your money where your mouth is and you're building something, you have a vision of something, you need to stick to it.
Last thing to wrap up on, we thought it would be topical given the world that we're in and the world that you're in. We imagine you're someone who gets a lot of these. So cold calls, we deliver them, you get them. From your standpoint, what's your genuine opinion on the reality of cold calls?
I take every cold call. More or less. Like if it's a completely crap time, I won't. But I take a cold call, and I had one. I was in Italy just before Christmas. My friend was getting married. He called me, and I got this cold call, and he said his standard blurb is like, "Hi, I'm John from so and so company," and so I said, "John, is this a cold call?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "John, I'm in Italy. I'm about to get on a lift. Call me in January, and I'll take your call then." And he did. I spoke to him again in January. So I do it for two reasons. One, I like to see what a good cold call sounds like. I'm yet to see a good one. And I like to like be part of it because I'm like, my team is doing it. I should take them. And I'm quite quick to say like, this is not interesting. And I think the best cold calls, even if they're not lined up well at the beginning of the call, are the ones where you're like, this is just not interesting and I don't have that problem and I don't care about what you're offering. Where they'll go, fair enough, cool, well, look, thanks, and put the phone down. Because it's like, don't waste my time. Don't try and tell me I have a problem when I don't believe I have a problem. Even if I do have a problem, if I don't believe I have a problem, I'm still not going to buy it. So it's pointless. So I like I like the cold callers that do that, that are a bit, bit more understand that their job is not to convince me, it's to purely find a prospect that has a problem. But I think most of them spend too much time talking about themselves. Very, very, very few cold calls ever start with, "Hey, here's three problems that we're here to solve. Do any of them resonate?" And I think that is, and obviously with you guys and our team now, with you guys coming in and working with us, is so refreshing and so powerful, because you can just get to the crux of like, yeah, actually that sounds interesting, and now I'm engaged. Versus, come on, you've spent 5 minutes talking about, the round of investment that you've recently had and stuff like that. It's like, I don't care.
I think your company is a great, so breaking the fourth wall, we've done some work together. Your company is an interesting one that I use as an analogy within our team, because you might be speaking to someone who's literally got like a power tool in their hand, up a ladder, doing some work, also running a business. And if your message can resonate enough, they'll come down the ladder, put that tool down and have a chat with you and say, you know what, some of that does apply in my world, and have a conversation with you about it.
But I
totally agree. If someone's busy and are doing that and they can't take the call, then let them. Don't try and convince them. If they haven't got the problem, don't try and be a slimy, sleazy, horrible Jordan Belfort wannabe and persuade them that they do have the problem. But Jason, I think there's loads to take away from that. I really appreciate it. I thought this would be a really good chat from all standpoint, and you haven't disappointed. If someone's listening to this and thinks, you know what, I want to learn more about Commusoft, what's the best way of starting that conversation?
Just on our website, commusoft.co.uk for the UK and commusoft.us for the US. Just have a look through, see if it's something that you think is going to solve a problem that you have. And if it does, then just, watch the demo video and someone will be in touch.
When's your book coming out on the Life and Times?
Yeah. Time for writing a book, God.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Jason. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
Guys. Thank you very much.
Cheers.